I'm Kelly Gardner and welcome to Imagining the Past. Imagining the Past is a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in the 2017 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference in Melbourne. Starting on the 8th of September, the conference will explore ideas around identity and writing in historical fiction. There'll be interviews, practical workshops, debates, and academic panels. You'll hear from the likes of Kerry Greenwood, Arnold Zabel, Juliet Marillier, and Deborah Challenor, and our podcast guests Kate Forsyth, Lucy Trelaw, Sophie Masson, Solari Gentile, and Robert Gott. You can find out more or buy tickets online at hnsa.org.au. Our guest for this episode is Lucy Trelaw. Lucy was born in Malaysia, educated in Melbourne, England and Sweden, and has also lived in Cambodia for several years. Lucy's debut novel, Salt Creek, was published in 2015 to critical acclaim. It won the Dobby Award, the Matt Ritchell Award for New Writers, and the Indie Award for Best Debut. It was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Literary Award, the Walter Scott Prize for Historical Fiction, and the Readings Prize for New Australian Writer. Lucy will appear twice at our conference in September, once to talk about the personal side of being a debut author, and also to discuss approaches to researching and writing about the colonial past. So Lucy, welcome. Let's focus on that for a moment. I imagine it's quite tricky balancing the brutal reality of 19th century settler attitudes to Indigenous people with your own sensibilities and that of the modern reader. How do you go about that tricky balance?
That was a constant struggle for me. And when I first started writing the book, I had a grand dream of including a huge amount of material about the Indigenous culture. And as I progressed with the writing, I came to realise that this was a really poor approach, and read more around kind of contemporary discourse about how to manage dealing with Indigenous issues. And had been in touch with the Narrangeri people. And for various reasons, I decided to pull right back from that approach. And I think one of the key ways that I managed that was by using a first-person narrator. And in a way, that first-person narrator is a sort of blinker that they can't see beyond, the reader can't see beyond. Neither you nor that narrator can assert that they know something that they would not have witnessed. And that was a tremendous help for me in proceeding forward with that. But it is an issue of incredible sensitivity. And I worried about it more or less incessantly for the whole time that I was writing, and felt quite anxious about it. And when the book finally came out and a couple of Indigenous people got in touch and said, you've told the story of my grandfather, referring to this Indigenous character, Tully, in the book, I heaved a huge sigh of relief. I'm still waiting for someone to get in touch and say, how dare you? And it hasn't happened yet, and fingers crossed it doesn't.
Because I suppose the thing about first person, though, is you also have to capture that worldview, which you do, the worldview of somebody who is unfamiliar with that culture, and in fact, perhaps hostile, or the people around her are hostile to the Indigenous people, who they see as being encroaching on their rights, on their land rights, in
yes.
Sort of reversal of how we would see it today.
Yes, that's true. What really interested me in the writing was that there were some people who were incredibly hostile, but there were also a huge number of people who were not hostile as much as they were uncomprehending, that they had no idea what they were seeing. So if they had Indigenous people on the land that they regarded as theirs burning down fences, they thought it was an act of vandalism, whereas in fact, from an Indigenous perspective, it was allowing the passage of the wildlife that they depended on, for kangaroos to move through this land freely. So I think there was this enormous mutual incomprehension. And on top of that, there was violence that came from a whole number of people. But also there were things like the settlers had no idea that the cattle that they had would foul the waterhole, so that the Indigenous people all depended on anything that they did had a massive impact on Indigenous people. Yeah.
And on the environment.
And which, on the environment, absolutely.
So can we talk a little bit about that environment? Because it's a world that you've recreated in this loving detail. And it's a world that you're very familiar with, aren't you?
I am. I am.
Can
I
was... talk a little bit about that, that place?
I wasn't terribly familiar with it in the beginning, or only through these family stories, very fragmentary family stories that I'd been hearing my whole life. We grew up in Melbourne, basically, but as often as we could, my family would move to South Australia for our family holidays. Both my parents are from South Australia. So it was always like this exodus from Melbourne and, you know, returning to the promised land of South Australia.
Driving all the way.
Driving
across
all the way. So many
in the
times.
Summer.
A Volkswagen, four children, a panting dog. I can't even tell you. So we would drive all the way across. And at this certain point when we got to the Coorong, my mother would say, and that's where your great-great-great-great-grandfather settled with his family. And we would look out and it's kind of a moonscape from the inland road. It's just salt bush and then this shimmering sky, and we would all be kind of panting and looking out. And yes, interesting, mother, can we get to the beach now, please? So we never stopped, and I didn't go until about 4 or 5 years ago, I suppose. I visited for the first time, and we actually went along the coast road, and it was like an electric shock. I couldn't believe that we'd never been there. It's so different when you get along the coast road. It's this glorious landscape. A lagoon that's filled with these very small islands that just kind of bob up like whales kind of lolling down this kind of stretch of water. And these enormous sand dunes, they called them sand hills then, on the other side of this lagoon. And I went on this expedition kayaking up and down the lagoon and traversing these sand hills. And all the time I was thinking, I have got to write this book. I can't believe no one's written this book before. And I was just so kind of determined to get going on it, and also a tiny bit paranoid, because I, you know, people would say, what are you writing? And I'd just say, oh, just a book, you know, set
it's not
South
set anywhere.
Australia. I can't say anything more than that. I was really worried that someone else would think of it first.
So you must have had to do quite a bit of research into the natural history of the place, which is kind of a process that you portray in the book as well, isn't it? Capturing how it was then.
Yes. Fortunately, this is an area of South Australia that has always been quite well written about. So there's a lot of anthropologists have written about it. There's quite a bit of oral history that's come down. And Charles Sturt wrote a diary that describes him going along this area and crossing the mouth of the Murray and their experiences. And there's quite a lot of also settler diaries of people who, you know, have been through this area and the landscape that they had. And one of the things I discovered to my shame was that my distant forebear who put sheep on the peninsula changed that landscape. It used to be very green, quite heavily bushed and so on. But the sheep sort of destroyed it in a way. You know, they wore it away and made huge changes to it. So those sorts of things I discovered. But, you know, early explorers described these sandhills as stupendous, awe-inspiring, all sorts of really kind of grand words. So I felt the grandness of it. And I felt it myself looking at it, but I could feel that other people had felt that before me. And I desperately wanted to bring that to life on the page.
And I suppose also in some of those settler diaries and in the book, because the family moves from Adelaide, doesn't it? And so it's quite, in a sense, it's capturing that settler experience of the alien landscape that really unsettled them in lots of ways and trying to come to terms with life in this place that felt very foreign to them.
Yes, foreign and terribly inhospitable, infertile, hostile, all words that suggested opposition. I think it took them an incredibly long time to see that world that was so hostile to them wasn't hostile to Indigenous people. And there's a kind of telling remark that my distant ancestor made in one of his diaries, that no good would ever come to Indigenous people of contact with colonial settlers. He recognised it.
He could see it even
then.
He
could see it. he wasn't the only one who could see it. And yet, in the face of self-interest, they would continue to do what they do, what they did. And we do the same thing. So in a way, the book is, it was a kind of a comment on the way we are today as well. It's a historical fiction. But to me, it was also a very contemporary novel in the things that it was exploring.
Do you think that's often the way with historical fiction, actually, that we write it and read it to reflect on the past but also to reflect on the present?
I do, actually. And I was very struck the year that Salt Creek came out, which was 2015, that there were a couple of novels, historical fictions, and some contemporary fictions as well, that were exploring the place that women could carve out for themselves in society. And I'm thinking of Robin Cadwallader's The Anchoress, and she's going to be at the conference as well. I'm really looking forward to hearing what she's got to say. She's looking at what power women can have, what autonomy they can have. I was looking at that. And Charlotte Wood was doing the same thing, actually, in The Natural Way of Things, and from a different kind of setting. And for me, they're all political novels. That what I felt when I was writing almost every day was, and now look what Tony Abbott's done. Well, no, I've got something to say about that. And so it was like this great big polemical thing for me in some ways. It was a huge argument against a discourse in political life in Australia that seemed to be turning against women. And I used the historical setting to discuss that. It was other things as well, but that was part of that writing of that book for me.
Against women and against Indigenous people,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
About the environment and climate change and so on, all happening at the same time. And I'm thinking too of Kate Mildenhall's Skylarking. Not similar in many ways, but it is also that young woman, the coming of age, colonial experience for white women as a coming of age experience as well, and understanding the world, the natural world, not as a hostile place necessarily.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's very true. And it's not, I mean, coming of age novels are always fascinating things for writers to explore. And there's a temptation for readers to think that there's some unfinished business for the writer in approaching that kind of material. But it is such rich material to tap into. It's not necessarily personal, but the feelings of being that age have a peculiarly heightened quality, I think, that translate very well to a fiction. And because readers also have very heightened awareness and memory of those stages in their own lives, there is this kind of intersection, I guess, between what the writer's doing and what the reader's doing. There's a great communication in the reading process that happens at that point, and it leads to a kind of rich reading experience, I think, that, you know, readers really connect to books.
We've all had to go through it.
We absolutely have, and probably wouldn't want to do it again.
Coming of age never gets old. That's the story
for sure.
Of
mm.
our lives. Mm. Could I just dig in a little bit more to the research process and what approach did you use? Did you sink yourself into lots and lots of detail at the beginning, or did you have a story and you start writing it and then you needed details? How did you go about that?
Yeah, it was a very strange kind of amorphous approach. I'm not a very organised writer. I don't write in a linear way. But I would write along where I felt that there was energy. And all the time that I was writing along, I would be reading any material that I came across about this place and this time. And sometimes I'd get a little bit stuck and I would just do a little bit more reading around it and just find out a few more little bits and pieces of information. But often it came from just following along strange, obscure facts. So, for instance, I was looking for early drawn images of this part of the Coorong, and there's a really important early Australian artist, George French Angus, who had painted beautiful watercolours, and they're gorgeous. But while I was searching on Trove, I came across this little kind of a sketchbook, really, by a young man, Charles Babbage, whose father was exploring through the area. And so I just thought, who are these Babbages? What were they doing trawling around the Coorong? And they'd been employed by the Adelaide Council to go off and explore and do some map making and so on. But I looked into their past. His father was a bosom buddy of Charles Darwin. He himself had gone off and worked in Howarth, where the Brontes lived, and had met the Brontes. And I had this kind of Jane Eyre connection. So it was just like some, you know, the past was kind of poking me with a stick and saying, how about this for a detail? What are you going to do with that? And so I, you know, I'd come across that kind of detail and think, right, that has got to go in somewhere.
That's not a detail anymore.
No,
that's,
it's not a detail.
It's characters.
But that was not in the original conception of the book. I just thought, fantastic, that's a story arc for Hester. And I'd been a little bit worried about that. But so if you kind of keep an open mind to these sorts of things, if you're prepared to just follow these sort of strange little noodly paths, to be prepared to wonder, and even, you know, when I was doing that research, I was procrastinating from writing in a way. But I came across this amazing material. And if I hadn't been procrastinating, I wouldn't have. So I just feel like if you're open to the book, you're open to the possibilities with a book. There is so much that will feed into the creation of it. It's almost inescapable, really. And, yeah, so that was one of those great discoveries, but an unexpected one for me.
So Trove, which is the National Library's search engine of lots of collections,
yes,
and newspapers and so on.
How wonderful
is it? One of our greatest tools, but also one of our greatest time wasters.
Or not.
Or not.
Yeah.
You never know what you'll find. It really is a trove. Mm.
Absolutely.
So did Salt Creek, at the beginning, did it feel like the germ of an idea, or did it always feel like a big kind of narrative idea?
What I had was about four fragments of family stories that seemed to me to be big enough that I could build something around them. So these fragments were the death of my great-great-great-grandmother being rowed across the Coorong in labour. So she died with an obstructed labour. My great-great-grandmother, Annie, who, family legend has it, ran wild with the blacks on the Coorong. And so I really wanted to explore what running wild with the blacks might mean.
They're the words in the legend.
They are the words. Yeah, exactly. And I feel terrible every time I say them. But
that's a quote.
Yes, and there's a huge amount of admiration and for Annie in family legend. And that there was a young boy, an Indigenous boy, who lived in the household with my forebears, and I was very curious about why that might have happened. He was the son of an Indigenous stockman, but was he was a mixed race, so he was part Indigenous, part colonial. And I was very curious about that, because if he was the son of an Indigenous stockman, who was his mother? And that was what gave me the idea about one whole narrative strand in the book. So these things were, they were key for me. And also the knowledge that there was this character, Malachi Martin, who was a murderer who lived further down from my family on the Coorong. And he's an historical figure. And I thought if I could fit all of these components in somehow, I could build a book around them. And I knew it would have to be a fairly big book because of the time frame I was working with. And the, you know, at the beginning, when the book was commissioned, my publisher said, don't be afraid to go big. And I said, oh, so exactly how big does that mean? She said, well, say, I don't know, 115,000. So I was consciously writing up to around that. And then when I handed it in, they, you know, they were very happy and they said, but, you know, go a bit bigger. So I, you know, wrote some more at that point.
And how big did it end up then?
It's 130.
Right.
Yeah, so it's a pretty big book. But I think all the time I was thinking about character, really. That was the key thing for me, that I wanted every one of those characters to have their own arc. They would have varying levels of prominence in the text. I wasn't thinking write an enormous book of, you know, sweeping themes and so on. I was thinking, I wonder what was going on for those characters in that place at that time, what was happening.
So you're blending in then, whether you ended up using their real names or not, you're blending in the stories of real people and real incidents with imagined scenes and imagined
people
place.
Too. Yes. Yeah.
So how did you balance all that? Mm. And what would you do if a real person's documented historical story did not match the narrative that you were imagining?
Well, there were so few people there at that time that there would be no one other than my own family to say, and probably an enormous number of other South Australians who are related to me, who I don't know, to say that is not what they were like at all. And that's why I changed the location and I changed the makeup of the family and kept only these fragments of stories. I just didn't want to have any suggestion that Stanton Finch, the father in this book, is my great-great-great-great-grandfather. I think my distant forebear was a relatively benign and well-liked sort of feckless person, very entrepreneurial but a little bit, prone to losing money. So in that way...
Not quite so prone.
No, not quite so prone. And in that way he was very similar to the Stanton Finch, but he was not a malign person, and the figure in the book is a really deeply... egotistical and unpleasant man. So I had to change those characters. Probably the closest person would be Addie, who is the younger sister of the book's narrator, Hester. And she, in my mind, is very like my great-great-grandmother, Annie. She's very lively, a bit kind of naughty, wicked, but very lovable, I hope. she's probably the closest. Yeah.
So how do you think yourself into or just find out about how people felt or thought about the world then?
I'm a big lover of Victorian literature. Not Dickens so much, but I really love the Brontes. Charlotte especially. So the character of Jane Eyre was important to me, and the book Jane Eyre was important to me in the writing, as a way of saying to the reader, these ideas about women were around then. There's nothing new about feminism. It is how far people get with these drives towards autonomy and self-expression. Jane Eyre in Haworth came to being out of the imagination of Charlotte Bronte in the early 1800s. Why not in the Coorong? And there was a massive flowering of education of women in middle class homes in that first stage of the Victorian era. But the idea was that the women would become better educated so that they would be better mothers in the home. That was the only aim. And then it's like there was this realization that if you have women who are educated, they're going to want more than just hanging around in the home. And there was a clamping down on that education. So there was this brief flowering and then a kind of squashing down. Hester and her family come out of that flowering, this kind of idea that women had brains, that they could be educated, that they could think in a sophisticated way. And then it was shutting down. And so there's this, a couple of little references to it starting to clamp down, that her parents don't let her bring her copy of Jane Eyre to the Coorong with her because they've decided it's too racy. and it is a pretty racy book. Yeah. So all of those things are really fascinating to me, how much you reveal of those times. It's so easy just to think of the Victorian era as a single kind of a block, this kind of squashing great oppressive block. But it was as fluid a time as we live in a lot of ways. And I wanted to explore that.
So you can read it's lucky because it's the relatively recent past compared to writing about, early Britain or something. Mm. You've got diaries of people and you've got the novels of the time or even a little bit earlier, do they help you with the voice as well? How do you get to that position of being able to portray the voice on the page?
So the voice, I just remembered Charles Darwin. I read a huge amount of Charles Darwin and, he was incredibly helpful in revealing Victorian attitudes, especially colonial attitudes towards the aggrandizing of a culture. So in terms of the voice on the page, what I had was a letter from a very distant great aunt, Emily, that described the family's move from Adelaide to the Coorong, and it describes it in some detail, them travelling by horse and cart until they got to some outpost, Langon Creek, which I've often driven through myself, and then they have to catch a bullock and dray to Wellington Punt, which I've also crossed many times myself, and then they cross that. And there's this incredible voice in this letter. And it was at that moment that my Hester character kind of leapt off the page. I thought, you're just a teenager, you're leaving all of your friends behind, and there's this awful kind of quality of sadness and despair. And she's writing to a friend of hers. She says, Minnie dear, you will not believe the time we've had. And I could just hear it so vividly. And I just started writing in her voice. And I wrote a few pages until I felt that I had I could write other stuff that she might have been noticing. And she sort of developed from that point. She's not exactly like that. The Hester character ends up quite a bit more intelligent, very mathematically inclined, whereas poor Emily is just, I can't wait to leave this awful place. And she's all, you know, the dust, my dear, and the flies, they're terrible. She's sort of locked into this moaning mode. But Hester ends up a more driven, much more driven and more aware, I suppose, of things around her than I think this prototypical character would have been.
Hopefully her life got better from there.
Oh, no. Sad stories. No, actually, this distant forebear, he had five daughters and they were all dead by the time they were in their 30s.
Oh, my
childbirth,
goodness.
All of them. That's natural childbirth.
That's right.
Yeah.
And lack of access to
medical that's right.
facilities. So so you extrapolated the voice from Emily from just this little letter. Is there anything that you discovered in your research that really surprised you?
Oh, yeah, there was actually. And I kept on... There were several things, but the one that really struck me was the incredibly mutable nature of people's movements through the land, the mutable nature of the contact with them, the unexplored land, the land that had been unexplored by colonials. So when I started writing the book, I thought that that the people who lived on the Coorong were going down into completely unexplored territory. Almost completely unexplored. But I discovered that in fact South Australians had been travelling this coast road for the previous 10 or 15 years to get to the Victorian goldfields, which was one of the things that had sent South Australia bankrupt at that stage. And but not long before this family, the Finches, moved to the Coorong, the inland route to the goldfields had been discovered. So there was this really well-travelled pathway that had suddenly fallen into disuse. So it had been like thousands of people had travelled down this route. There were roadhouses along the way. And then suddenly it was a backwater. Everything through there was like a ghost town, I suppose. But the signs of people having passed that way would have been everywhere. There would, you know, the inns that were along the way were all going bust because the gold diggers weren't there anymore. And for this family, they could see the signs of settlers having gone through. But now it's just this kind of dirt track and no sign of anything. So I was really interested in the idea of civilizations just rising and falling, this incredible mutability in social structures all the way through there that happened so quickly. So within 20 years of Adelaide being settled, this road had kind of risen up and then fallen away. And those coastal towns had grown and then just almost died so quickly. And that's how quickly society can change. And that's how quickly society can be destroyed, sadly, as well.
Yeah.
As we see with the Indigenous people of the region.
So that's, and now I see in the text you have this landscape with all these pathways, different pathways of different people not necessarily all crossing, and it's going back to the not comprehending one another thing. Some of the like ghost pathways, in a sense, of people who are no longer walking that way or travelling that way because either they've been displaced or because the road is no longer in use, and the land feeling empty to some people but not being empty at all.
No. And when you're there still, you can feel these old pathways. They're these sort of ghostly tracks, and you think, well, where's that going to? And, they're everywhere. And I think that in a way we all need to learn to see those things, that the people who know what they mean, what these little ghostly trails are, it would be so great if they could tell people that this is what they meant. When we were children, we lived in, I grew up in the eastern suburbs basically, and there was a fantastic gully that we lived in. And on the edge of this gully, there were these steps carved into the clay edge of this sort of creek bed, which we just used without thinking. But we were the first people living out there, the first colonials living out there, you know, in the 60s. And we just used that pathway. But now I look back on it and I think, well, probably those neat steps that had been so thoughtfully carved into the edge of the creek bed had been thoughtfully carved several thousand years before. And we just decided that that was our spot now. And that's the sort of thing that happens everywhere across the country. It's fascinating to me that these kind of hidden pasts that are waiting to be discovered.
And told in stories.
Yes, absolutely. I always say to people, get out there and write your stories. I've heard so many amazing stories. People come and chat to me after festivals, and they kind of come up and say, I just have to tell you this thing that my grandmother told me. And I just think, write them down, write them. I'm always saying, write the stories, write them, because they'll be lost. And I felt that with my, you know, my family stories, that I didn't know who either of my children would be thinking about passing those stories along.
So you wrote about them instead.
I did.
So people, get out there and write your stories down.
Yes, do.
Lucy, thank you so much for being part of this.
Oh, such a pleasure.
And we'll see you in September.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Imagining the Past is a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in the 2017 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference in Melbourne. Throughout the weekend of the 8th to the 10th of September, the conference explores ideas around identity and writing in historical fiction. There'll be interviews, discussions, practical workshops, and academic panels. With over 60 speakers featured, you'll hear from the likes of Kerry Greenwood, Arnold Zabel, Juliet Marillier, and Melissa Ashley. And our podcast guests, including Deborah Challenor, Lucy Treloar, Sophie Masson, Zulara Gentile, and Robert Gott. And me, I'm Kelly Gardner. You can find out more or buy tickets online from hnsa.org.au.